our opening words this morning, and indeed our closing words and words for meditation and several other words in between, will be by the poet Mary Oliver. This is Trying to Be Thoughtful in the First Brights of Dawn. I am thinking, or trying to think, about all the imponderables for which we have no answers, yet endless interest all the range of our lives, and it's good for the head, no doubt, to undertake such meditation. Mystery, after all, is God's other name and deserves our consideration surely. But, excuse me now, please, it's morning, heavenly bright, and my irrepressible heart begs me to hurry on into the next exquisite moment. Michelle's gonna join me now for our message for all ages, and we're going to be reading and talking about a poem by Mary Oliver titled Watering the Stones. But first I wanted to tell you just a little bit about why. Many of you may be aware of the poet Mary Oliver. Do you have a question?
Oh, no, I actually know what happened.
You know what happened?
Yes.
What happened? That's right. She died about a month ago, and that is one of the reasons why we're talking about her now. She's one of the most beloved of contemporary American poets, and while she's not a Unitarian Universalist, as she was not a member of any organized religion, she held a lot of beliefs that she shared through her poetry that I think are very harmonious with Unitarian Universalism, and I think really harken back to the Transcendentalists. Anyone who know who the Transcendentalists were? That's a big word. Well, some of the adults are like, yeah, I do. Transcendentalists was a period of literary and philosophical thought and writing that happened right up the road in Concord, primarily in New England here, and that it really put forth a theory that each person can connect to God in their own way and really through nature. So Henry David Thoreau, who wrote Walden and talked about living out on Walden Pond, was a transcendentalist. And I think later I'm going to read two of Mary Oliver's poems that talk about Walden and walking in the woods that I think connect to that. So that's just a little bit by way of introduction. And then I'm going to ask Michelle to read the poem that we're going to talk about.
All right. And first I'm going to tell you, sometimes when not even just kids, but adults and kids hear the word poems or poetry, they're like, ooh. And I have to say, Mary Oliver, I'd not really heard of her before because I'm not a big poetry person. And Cindy asked me if I could find a couple poems that might work for kids. And I looked through many of her poems, and some of them were beyond my understanding, but many of them were just so beautiful about how much she loved the earth. And this one really I made connections with, and I thought a lot of you all might make connections with this poem too. It's called Watering the Stones. Every summer, I gather a few stones from the beach and keep them in a glass bowl. Now and again, I cover them with water, and they drink. There's no question about this. I put tin foil over the bowl tightly, yet the water disappears. This doesn't mean we ever have a conversation, or that they have the kind of feelings that we do. Yet it might mean something. Whatever the stones are, they don't lie in the water and do nothing. Some of my friends refuse to believe it happens, even though they've seen it. But a few others, I've seen them walking down the beach holding a few stones, and they look at them rather more closely now. Once in a while, I swear, I've even heard one or two of them saying, "Hello," which I think does no harm to anyone or anything, does it?
Thank you for sharing that, Michelle. So this poem talks about gathering stones as she walks down the beach. And I think that's something a lot of us have done or picked up something in nature as we're walking along. Do you ever do that?
I actually always pick up stones when I walk on the beach. Sometimes I need to remind myself to look at the ocean and the water because I'm so focused on finding just the right stone. And I love to find a really polished stone that fits just right in my hand. And I usually keep it for a while and use it as a worry stone, something that I carry with me, and just kind of fidget with as a reminder of the beauty of the ocean. And I know that you have a very close attachment to stones that come from
From my home in Michigan. Yes. So in Michigan, we don't have the ocean, but we do have some pretty great lakes. And I have spent many times over the years on the shores of those lakes picking up stones. One kind of stone that you can find on the lakes on the shores of Lake Michigan that I have never found myself, but which are very plentiful up near the closer to the Upper Peninsula, are called Petoskey stones. And I put a picture of one of them on the cover of your order of service. Petoskey stones are the state stone of Michigan, and even though they're called a stone, they're actually a fossil. So they have this little hexagonal pattern all over them, and those were once living organisms. And you find these stones along Lake Michigan. And when I started my ministry at the church in Michigan that I served before coming here, my director of religious education there gave me this Petoskey stone necklace. And so I wear that often and think of both Michigan, and I think of religious education, and I think about our connection to nature. Our words for prayer or meditation are titled Morning Poem. I think this is one of the three Mary Oliver poems that is in our hymnal as well. Every morning the world is created under the orange sticks of the sun. The heaped ashes of the night turn into leaves again and fasten themselves to the high branches. And the ponds appear like black cloth on which are painted islands of summer lilies. If it is your nature to be happy, you will swim away with the soft trails for hours, your imagination alighting everywhere. And if your spirit carries within it the thorn that is heavier than lead, if it's all you can do to keep on trudging, there is still somewhere deep within you a beast shouting that the earth is exactly what it wanted. Each pond with its blazing lilies is a prayer heard and answered lavishly every morning, whether or not you have ever dared to be happy, whether or not you have ever dared to pray. During the month of February, our church has been joining with the UU churches in Concord and Sudbury, as well as the synagogue in Acton and the Maynard Anti-Racism Alliance, to read the names of lynching victims in the U.S. Each church or agency or religious institution chose a different state to focus on, and the names that we've chosen were all from the state of Georgia. So that connected back to the story I told at the beginning of the month about my ancestry in Georgia. It was, you know, a sort of random choice because there are plenty of names, sadly, to share. The point of this observance is to honor the memory of those whose lives were so unfairly cut short, as well as to encourage us to be aware of the racial violence that still exists in our communities, our nation, and our world, and our opportunity and responsibility to be the change that we want to see in the world. There's an insert in your bulletin that tells more about this observance and lists the names that we're reading each Sunday. We've done this in a way particularly to be accountable to communities of people of color by receiving help from and counsel from the Black Lives UU organization, which is the organization we share our plate with this month, and also getting advice and counsel from the Maynard Anti-Racism Alliance that coordinated this project. As we enter into a time of reverent observance and listening to the names that are read, I offer this quote from the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. For the hanged and beaten, for the shot, drowned, and burned, for the tortured, tormented, and terrorized, for those abandoned by the rule of law, we will remember. With hope, because hopelessness is the enemy of justice. With courage, because peace requires bravery. With persistence, because justice is a constant struggle. With faith, because we shall overcome. And now I invite forward Lisa Fagerstrom, who introduced herself to you earlier, to read the names, and then we'll follow the reading of the names with a moment of musical meditation.
William Mobley. John Brown. Benjamin Brown. Jonah Woods. Paul Reed. Jim Toller. Ella Barber. Eula Barber. Daniel Barber. Jesse Barber. John Shake. Three unnamed black males. On July 4th, 1910, in Montgomery, Georgia, three unnamed black males were shot for annoying whites by being boisterous. Private Felix Hall. On March 29, 1941, Private Felix Hall was found dead hanging from a tree on a segregated military base in Fort Benning, Georgia. The government claimed that there was a War Department investigation and that the FBI, the Department of Justice, and Fort Benning were cooperating. The War Department confirmed that they conducted an investigation, but never released findings.
Our first reading is Going to Walden. It isn't very far as highways lie. I might be back by nightfall, having seen the rough pines and the stones and the clear water. Friends argue that I might be wiser for it. They do not hear that far-off Yankee whisper, how dull we grow from hurrying here and there. Many have gone and think me half a fool to miss a day away in the cool country. Maybe. But in a book I read and cherish, going to Walden is not so easy a thing as a green visit. It is the slow and difficult trick of living and finding it where you are. My second reading is How I Go to the Woods. Ordinarily, I go to the woods alone, with not a single friend, for they are all smilers and talkers, and therefore unsuitable. I don't really want to be witnessed talking to the catbirds or hugging the old black oak tree. I have my way of praying, as you no doubt have yours. Besides, when I am alone, I can become invisible. I can sit on the top of a dune as motionless as an uprise of weeds until the foxes run by unconcerned. I can hear the almost unhearable sound of the roses singing. If you have ever gone to the woods with me, I must love you very much. So I love poetry, and I forget that not everyone does, because I just love it so much. I have shelves and shelves. Well, I would have shelves and shelves if all my books were unpacked. A lot of my books are still in boxes, and will be until we buy a house this summer. But I have books that are mostly anthologies of poetry, a lot from my college days, the Norton Anthology of Modern Poetry, the Norton Anthology of English literature from this period to this period. Sometimes I've collected anthologies by particular racial or ethnic groups, poetry by women, poetry that is spiritual in nature, poetry of the Holocaust. I have a couple volumes of that, poetry from particular time periods or literary periods. But I have a lot of poetry by individual poets, too. Rumi, Pablo Neruda, Walt Whitman, Anne Sexton, E.E. Cummings, Dorothy Parker, which I love. She's so sarcastic. H.D., Marianne Moore. The list goes on. Lots of poetry. And it's a spiritual practice of mine to read poetry. I find it something that helps me calm down, helps me meditate, helps me connect to the life of the spirit. Usually, I only have really one book per poet, and then I move on to another poet and get another one book per poet. Usually, you know, the most popular book or an anthology of that collects several of their books together. And so I was surprised when I started pulling off my books off my shelf in preparation for this service to realize I have 5 books by Mary Oliver. I didn't know that. I don't know that if you had asked me who my favorite poet is, that I necessarily would have said Mary Oliver. But the bookshelf does not lie, and 5 books it is. I don't have any other poet that I have 5 books of, unless you count Shakespeare's plays. Our UU hymnal tells a similar story, and because we have 3 of her poems anthologized in there, and that's compared to 1 poem for Robert Frost, or 1 poem for Rumi, who is one of the most beloved of poets these days, of spiritual poets. There are people who have more readings, but usually they're UUs, like Emerson has a bunch. But some of those are hymns. But for just poetry, we have an unusually high amount, I think, in there. Mary Oliver very quietly and slowly, I think, became one of America's favorite poets. She's often been discounted and overlooked, kind of poo-pooed by literary critics who think that maybe discount her work as overly simplistic, probably because it's so accessible. As Michelle said, some of it can be quite dense, but much of it is very, very accessible to people. Her poems, to me, evoke the transcendentalist spirit of Emerson and Thoreau, and I think there's a reason for that, as she mentions both of them in her poems. And the transcendentalists believe that every person could experience God or the divine directly and often through nature. Mary Oliver shows us how to do that over and over again in her poetry. In The New Yorker, Rachel Syme writes of Oliver, "With her consistent, shimmering reverence for flora and fauna, Oliver made herself one of the most beloved poets of her generation. She worked in the romantic tradition of Wordsworth or Keats, but she also infused a distinctly American loneliness into her words, the solitary reflections of Thoreau gazing over a lake, or of Whitman peering from the Brooklyn Ferry at the shuffling tides below his feet. Her poems," she writes, "were not poems about isolation, though, but about pushing beyond your own sense of emotional quarantine, even when you feel fear. Everywhere you look, in Oliver's verse, you find threads of connectivity." Some of Oliver's poems almost follow a formula. Look at this piece of nature intently and discover a deeper meaning about life. So she looks at poppies and says, "Light is an invitation to happiness." She looks at the sun and says, "Have you ever felt for anything such wild love?" Or one of my favorites and most popular poems is "The Summer Day," in which she looks at a grasshopper and says, "I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention. How to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" As a brief aside, Oliver has talked about writing that poem in one of her rare interviews. She said, "One thing about that poem, which I think is important, is that the grasshopper actually existed. And yet I was able to fit him into that poem. And the sugar he was eating was part of frosting from a Portuguese lady's birthday cake, which was not important to the poem. But even seeing that little creature come to my plate and say, I'd like a little helping of that, it somehow fascinates me that. It's just personal for me that it was Mrs. Segura, probably her 90th birthday cake or something. What's fascinating for me is that many times I just see the grasshopper or the blackberry when I'm out in nature, the water snake or the owl, and that's it. But for Oliver, she connects through them, past them, into the great mysteries of life. Oliver's spirituality was experienced through nature, and she wasn't part of any one organized religion. While I'm not the only one to claim her as a transcendentalist, as I dove into her writings this week, I found articles about her spirituality written by spiritual leaders from Catholicism, from Judaism, from Buddhism. In an interview with Krista Tippett, she says, "It's been one of my most important interests of my life and continues to be, and it doesn't have to be Christianity. I'm very much taken with the poet Rumi, who is a Muslim, a Sufi poet, and read him every day and have no answers, but have some suggestions. I know that a life is much richer with a spiritual part to it, and I also think that nothing is more interesting, so I cling to it." While she's beloved by spiritual people of many faiths, Mary Oliver perhaps is the perfect poet for Unitarian Universalists because of just that. She doesn't give the answers, just suggestions, or sometimes not answers, but the deeper questions. For example, in one poem, she asks, "What can we do about God who makes and then breaks every God-forsaken beautiful day?" The locations of nature that Oliver goes back to again and again are here in her beloved New England. While the ones from our reading are about Walden up in Concord, Oliver lived in Provincetown for many years, and many of her poems are set on the Cape. She lived there with her partner, Molly Malone, and their dog, Percy, who is named in several poems, and I think has a whole book, one of the books I don't have, that is mostly about poems about Percy. In an article in The New Yorker, Beth Franklin writes this of Mary Oliver. "Oliver's work hews so closely to the local landmarks, Blackwater Pond, Herring Cove Beach, that a travel writer at the Times once put together a self-guided tour of Provincetown using only Oliver's poetry. She did occasional stints of teaching elsewhere, but for the most part stayed unusually rooted to her home base. People say to me, wouldn't you like to see Yosemite, the Bay of Fundy, the Brooks Range?" she wrote in her essay collection, Long Life. I smile and answer, "Oh yes, sometime," and go off to my woods, my ponds, my sun-filled harbor, no more than a blue comma on the map of the world, but to me, the emblem of everything. I think Mary Oliver teaches us through her poetry how to embrace life. In her poem, Messenger, she said, "My work is loving the world." She goes on to explain that she loves sunflowers, hummingbirds, the clam in the sand, the blue plums. And in her poem, What Can I Say?, she says, "Take your busy heart to the art museum and the Chamber of Commerce, but take it also to the forest." She asks us questions, constantly asking us to delve deeper. In Swan, she says, "Have you finally figured out what beauty is for? And have you changed your life?" The poem that I find a personal blueprint is her poem, What I Have Learned So Far. I'll read it in its entirety. And then I invite you to take another brief break here and turn to one another and answer the question, when you sit looking into the shining world, what image, what idea, what place, thought makes you passionately respond, makes you ignited? So here's the poem. Meditation is old and honorable, so why should I not sit every morning of my life on the hillside looking into the shining world? Because properly attended to, delight as well as havoc is suggestion. Can one be passionate about the just, the ideal, the sublime, and the holy, and yet commit to no labor in its cause? I don't think so. All summations have a beginning. All effect has a story. All kindness begins with the sown seed. Thought buds towards radiance. The gospel of lights is the crossroads of indolence or action. Be ignited or be gone. Mary Oliver also, as much as she talks about life, she also teaches us about death. In Blackwater Woods, which I'll share as our closing words, she says, "Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this, the fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation and whose meaning none of us will ever know." In that same interview with Krista Tippett, she says, "The world is pretty much everything is mortal. It dies, but parts don't die. Its parts become something else. We know that when we bury a dog in the garden and with a rose bush on top of it, we know that there is replenishment, and that's pretty amazing. What more there might be, I don't know, but I'm pretty confident of that one." And perhaps nowhere else does she address death so clearly as in the line that was often quoted after her own death. "When it's over, I want to say all my life I was a bride married to amazement." So one more time, I'm going to invite you to talk to your neighbor. When Mary Oliver says, "When it's over, I want to say all my life I was a bride married to amazement," what comes to mind for you? What's one thing you want to be remembered for after you're gone? Or what amazement do you find in this world that you want to remember for your lifetime? I'm going to close with a poem that she calls one of her prose poems from her book, What Do We Know? "How wonderful. I speak of the soul, and seven people rise from their chairs and leave the room. Seven others lean forward to listen. I speak of the body, the spirit, the mockingbird, the hollyhock, leaves opening in the rain, music, faith, angels seen at dusk, and seven more people leave the room and are seen running down the road. Seven more stay, but they are where they are, but make murmurous, disruptive sounds. Another seven hang their heads, feigning disinterest, though their hearts are open. Their hope is high that they will hear the word even again. The word is already for them the song in the forest. They know already how everything is better, the dark trees less terrible, the ocean less hungry when it comes forth and looks around with its crisp and lovely eye and begins to sing." A piece of the poem in Blackwater Woods. "Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime comes back to this, the fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go."